Happy winter. Today is the winter solstice. The days now get longer. Solstices and equinoxes and celestial movements offer a kind of dharma, it seems to me, of just remembering the bigger picture. We have our little human issues, but for the solstice, even humanity itself is a little issue. The winter solstice is like the end of a long 6 month out-breath. It's a pause for a moment before the in-breath naturally arises and life is renewed up to the summer solstice, where there's a pause before that long, deep exhale. So it's good to look at the minutia of our practice, but I think it's always nice to start with the big picture, to put it in context. That's the big kind of celestial picture. And somehow recently I came across this bit of information too, that's I think also a way to look at the bigger picture, one step down from the solstice to more like the human realm. Maybe I can see if anyone can guess this. You know, you can Google all these numbers and facts. How many humans, people, are born every minute on this planet? Any guesses? Just approximately, just for fun? I would never have even known where to start guessing, but...
10,000.
Every minute? Every minute. So 10,000. Seven?
Five.
It is somewhere between 7,000 and 5,000. So those were close. 250. I mean, how do you even guess that kind of thing, right? But what a wonderful fact, I thought, to contemplate as we sit here in this Dharma talk. Since the talk started, there's probably been about 750 humans actually born. We're not talking about a theory. These are like human lives born onto the planet. Like the miracle of a new human life with all its future complexity is happening as we speak.
That's how we got here.
That's how we got here. And, you know, all over into all different extremely painful and extremely joyful situations. And this was even more surprising, though, I thought. According to, like, various Google sites, how many humans on Earth die every minute?
Less than that number.
Less than that number. Somehow I kind of figured it would be pretty much the same. Now that you know 250 born a minute, any guesses on how many die a minute?
175.
Pretty close, but even more radical.
101.
Yeah, 105.
That's all.
So that's all. 250 born every minute, 105 die every minute.
Wow.
That was shocking to me.
That's including wars too.
And I don't know, you know, how, what time scale they're talking about here, but dying of any, you know, dying of any causes. As you might know, when you look at the population growth too, it's like in 1850 there were 1 billion people on the planet. In 1960 there were 3 billion. It tripled, right? And now in 2015 there's 7 billion. So that's kind of has to do with this numbers of born and dying. And I, you know, I don't know the complexity of all the reasons. I think modern medicine is probably a huge part. Yes.
An interesting fact that I've heard is that the ongoing carrying capacity for people all to live a good life is 500 million on the planet. If we want to keep going and have enough for everyone, and not,
oh, I see.
Not too much, mm-hmm. and not create global warming.
Uh-huh. A sustainable number of people.
Sustainable number of humans.
Yeah, which at one point we had on the Earth, and I don't think we're going to get back to that, except through our own causes. It might, cause and effect might play out just that way to keep everything in balance. So, there's nothing particular I actually wanted to say about these these numbers, except that it's the big picture, right? It's like it puts our life in perspective, our biggest problems and issues start to seem pretty small when we think about each minute, all these births, each minute, all these deaths. So now to kind of like zoom in a little bit to our life here and now, our situation, our practice, since we're here in a zendo, what is our zen practice? Many ways we could talk about it, right? So for me recently, it's been arising in this body and mind that the heart of the practice for me, my vow these days is complete acceptance. The wish to deeply accept, particularly these 7 billion people. Also accept inanimate things like earthquakes and tsunamis and such, but particularly other sentient beings, humans in particular, deeply accept. So easy, right? So simple. So difficult. To deeply accept. And partly that's about understanding others, listening to others. The other day, I felt the impact of this vow, this intention, and I said to Shoho, I really have to deepen my listening, and there's no end to the deepening of my listening. And she said, yes, there is an end. And my first thought was to try to argue with that. Don't listen anymore to that kind of crazy talk. What do you mean? How could there ever be an end to deepening one's listening? But instead, I thought, why don't I just listen to what she has to say? I said, well, if there's an end, what is it? True open curiosity, what is the end to listening? And she said, when the listener and the listened to are joined as one. That's the end, that's the complete depth of listening, and there's no deeper. It actually stops. I mean, the listening can go on, but the deepening is complete. It's the complete depth of listening. Follow? I thought it was a beautiful, like, a turning word for me. Shifted my perspective. So I recently came across this unpublished Dharma talk from my teacher Tenshin Roshi at Green Dragon Temple on a Sunday morning in 2002. Where he says, the basic principle of the practice here is summarized by saying, here's another version of the whole basic practice, is summarized by saying that the accomplishment of the protection of all beings comes through the examination of our own mistakes. So I thought this is closely related to deeply listening, and it's closely related to complete acceptance of others, examining our own mistakes. And this is a year after 9/11 attack on the World Trade Centers, and that's part of the theme of this longer talk is the world situation, world violence, and so on. But the basic principle of the practice here is summarized by saying that the accomplishment of the protection of all beings comes through the examination of our own mistakes, not the examination of other people's mistakes, not through talking about other people's mistakes. That sometimes might be helpful, but that isn't really what protects people. What protects people is for me to examine my own mistakes, he says. If I hit someone, generally that's liable to be a mistake. Beings, including me, are protected by me examining that mistake. In other words, the people that we might hit a second time are protected by me examining that, and I'm protected from being hit by that person by examining my own mistakes. The path is the path of examining mistakes. So this is one way to talk about Zen practice. It's not like maybe our usual way, but I think it's a good one. And there's like layers of types of mistakes. There's the obvious ones like hitting someone, and then there's the, you know, very subtle mistakes of like believing that others are not us, things like this, right? That's the mistake we're almost continuously making to some degree. So Roshi goes on, this is on the personal level, one-to-one in the community. Another kind of mistake that's going on in this world is the mistake that arises from, excuse the expression, a kind of archetypal bonding, a kind of mass bonding with some image and also some collective sense of what is right. So this is like societal, kind of like national and global levels. He goes on, when a group of people can bond together and conform to some value together at the expense of their differences, putting aside their differences for the time being, there's a great power and usefulness in that. A great cultural achievement can come from that. You can put on some good shows. You can build pyramids. You can have big rallies where a million people come together and rally around a symbol where our differences are suppressed, where conformity is held up as the main point. So I think this is the kind of thing, it struck me reading this, that the kind of thing that's going on in our country these days. Big movements of people rallying around certain ideas that are generally speaking kind of against other ideas. And I think any individual in these big mass groups of people, there's, he says, this archetypal bonding, mass bonding with an image or an idea. Most of the individuals in these masses, I would imagine, probably think and believe that they're right. Otherwise, they might be in a little bit of doubt, and they go for the bigger mass, and that's maybe for some people that may be enough. We'll just go with the most popular mass, and we'll assume that the most numbers mean that that's right. Unfortunately, maybe a lot of us can, without really examining ourselves, can just kind of go along with that. But I think also many of us feel like, no, I'm joining that particular mass because it really is right. You know, this is kind of tricky because it gets a little dangerous to say everything is actually equal. That's, I think, going too far. But it's just pointing out how these putting aside differences to create something great like a pyramid or a great show is powerful, but it's you know, it could have dangers too. So Tenshin Roshi goes on, but in the psyche of the people in these situations, there's something missing. Something has been denied, and that generates the projection of this other, which is hated and evil. It's kind of like it's happening in this world. This is going on. Mass bonding and mass projection of the hated evil other. So doesn't that naturally happen? I mean, it's almost like it's so obvious. This is almost like a summary of the news these days. And I think it happens on big national levels, and it happens on community levels and individual levels too. We set up an ideal, and then we look at those who are not in accord with our ideal, and we could say we don't fully listen to them, so we just don't understand their ideal and assume it's wrong, and we don't accept them. So I think this, I want to work on listening and acceptance, particularly of the views that are like seem most wrong to me and seem like they're really I don't understand them. In a way, I could say I don't understand them partly because I'm not listening as deeply as I could. I'm definitely not listening to the point, as Shoho says, where the depth of my listening has ended at being one with the other. So later in this talk, Tenshin Roshi goes on to say, when I first started teaching Zen, especially when I started training priests, I thought my job was to make them into little me's. Even make them exactly the same size and shape of me. And you know, for some reason or other, I wasn't successful. I couldn't. I wasn't able to coerce them into conforming with being me. They tried, actually, for a while. But you know, somehow it didn't work out. So I switched policies to helping them be them. Like, you know, them. Like other than me. Not me. What could be more obnoxious? Because it's not just another version of a person, it's another version of true Zen practice. Now that's really scary, right? To let them interpret the true Dharma in some way other than me. There's supposed to be only the only true practice, so how can there be another version of it? One can see how that line of reasoning sounds pretty good, doesn't it? Therefore, shouldn't they be like me? But he says, no, the true practice is not like this, not like that. This is self-righteousness. Have you ever noticed that? This is the right way. That's a different way, and that's the wrong way. This is a really important thing we're doing here. So that's a mistake. That's the kind of thinking we can get into. I've gotten into that kind of thinking quite easily, actually. In a way, the more we're committed wholeheartedly to this practice, I think the easier it is to get into that kind of thinking. That we really care. We really want it to be right. And if we're committed to it, we better know what's right ourselves, or else what are we even doing, right? It's maybe easier to commit to something which doesn't have such a strong importance. Like, I don't know, maybe importance isn't quite the right word, but like, say like I'm really committed to bird watching. Something I love to do it, and I do it every week or something. But essentially, like the stakes aren't quite as high somehow. If somebody says, "Well, that bird that you thought you saw like 10 of them, you know, every week in this area, that's not really the bird that you thought it was. Look in the book here; it's actually one of these." You might be like, "Oh, no, I really didn't notice." It's not like you would get in like a fight with them, probably, or. But like these religious, spiritual kind of ideals, that's where we're like, this is not just a matter of what kind of bird it is, right? This is a matter of birth and death. We care. We have to protect the true Dharma. And we see what happens when religions, from the beginning of religions in this world, have felt very committed to their religion. It can cause like huge disasters because they should be like me. This is self-righteousness. So he goes on, no one possesses ultimate truth. A catchphrase I once heard was, the truth will set us free, but doubting it will set us freer. That's a good one, huh? The truth will set us free, but doubting it will set us freer. And, you know, the Zen spiritual tradition, maybe pretty good. It's still a tradition that can get stuck in its ways, but it tends to be a little bit more on the questioning side, on the lighthearted side, on the you know, completely overturning our current understanding again and again, as we celebrate this in Zen and the stories of the Zen ancestors who really feel like they got something. Like when we really develop a lot of understanding, wisdom, and a deep practice. It's kind of like climbing to the top of a 100-foot pole, and then the Zen ancestors will say, we have to take a step forward from the top of that pole, from all the ideas that we hold about it. Leap completely beyond all of them. This is challenging. then don't we just maybe end up back on the ground where we started and have to do it again? Maybe not. But there's that risk. So I've got my truth and you've got your truth, but doubting my truth sets me free of my truth so I can appreciate your truth. That's the kind of summary of this. Later in the article, in his talk, he says, "We evolve together not by making everybody the same as us, but actually by appreciating each other. And that's hard. And the other way is really not possible either, that we can get people to conform to our view. So since it's not even really possible to get them to agree with us, to get everyone to agree with us, or maybe even anyone to agree with us completely, since it's impossible, then how about appreciating them where they're at instead? Maybe, he goes on, we can encourage each other to do the little bit that we can do by working on ourselves and bringing our practice to each meeting with other people, letting them practice or not practice. And then he kind of catches himself with that, saying that. Letting people practice or not practice if they want. But then he says, or actually I should say, practice the way they want to practice. I hear that as a kind of caught myself saying, well, some people just aren't practicing, right? And we can just let them not practice. And I'm like, but that's kind of like assuming that they're not practicing, right? So actually, let them practice the way they want to practice. Try to find, again, any sign in ourselves that we don't respect the way they're practicing. Admit that disrespect and admit that disrespect and admit that disrespect and admit that disrespect until we get low enough to see something to respect. To come off our high horse, get down on the ground with the bugs and see how wonderful people are. Express that appreciation. In that appreciative environment, maybe they can also start to notice their ordinariness and come off their high horses. And we can all get down so low that there's nowhere to go except forward on the path. So, listening, appreciation, respect, and acceptance. Maybe acceptance sounds easier in a way than appreciation. It's almost adding in even more. Acceptance is almost kind of neutral. Like at least it's not being against or thinking they should be different. And then appreciation is kind of adding in some positive too. But I think starting with acceptance and I feel that a little bit like this story of my teacher talking about his when starting to teach wanting everyone to be like him, I resonate with that story myself. And when I think back to the years when I first arrived here at Santa Cruz Zen Center, fresh from the monastery in the mountains with a vision of like, we're not going to do that like wimpy practice like the monastery. We're going to do like the real thing, not like Tassajara. We're going to do like serious practice, you know, a kind of like very idealistic vision. And it's kind of oppressive to have an idealistic vision, both especially to others, but then to oneself too, because not only can oneself not live up to it, but when others don't live up to one's own ideals, then that's so annoying. So I don't know, is it possible to go so far the other way? This is an open question I have. to be so accepting that we just almost like anything goes, actually, right? We might even say, at some point, if it's about, we want to create a place where we're not like, you know, obviously, you know, explicitly really harming each other. Like we say, well, let's just have a brawl during Zazen every day. You know, so that's maybe like, no, I can see how that's too much to accept that. I mean, if it happens, we can maybe accept it. But where's the limit, right? Where, I mean, I have these questions a lot. Because what are we offering in a Zen center? So, as an example, someone recently came and had the practice of doing Zazen, lying down on the floor. And we do have that, that form that's possible, usually for people with back injuries or something where it's painful to sit upright. Usually it's sort of like we try different sitting postures, like a chair leaning back on the chair with various types of support cushions. And then if that's still painful, we do have this like lying down practice. I think it's appropriate and wonderful. It's something, it's an innovation that's probably never happened in Japan, for example. That's one of our acceptance practices. I think it's beautiful. But somebody recently came and was lying down, and so I was talking with him, like, do you have a back injury or something? And he's like, no, I see I'm totally fine sitting upright. I just like to meditate lying down. It's more relaxing. But I can sit in a very nice posture for a long time even, and that's okay too. But I just prefer the lying down thing. So it's almost like a koan, or it's an open question for me. I kind of encourage this person to say, well, we are, you know, this part of what we're offering here is this unique practice of a particular posture, which then we adapt as needed. But generally, it's not like you can just, we don't encourage people anyway to just sit or lie or run around the zendo however they want, just out of preference. But so he was happy trying to like, oh, okay, well, I'll work with the sitting for a while, see how that goes. But I wondered, I thought, is that too like judgmental or too much like feeling like there really is the right way to sit? I think I might have told him it's not really that it's the right way to sit upright, but it's just what we're offering in this particular tradition. It's kind of like a yoga class to come in and be like, well, I'm just going to actually do cartwheels instead. Maybe you could at a yoga class do that. I would maybe wonder, well, why doesn't the person find a cartwheel group instead of the yoga class, since that's what people are doing? But you see how it's a kind of an open question. I felt a little doubt about what the appropriate response is to that kind of situation. So yes, Michael.
Where I see the difference is if I have a personal practice and I want to stand on one leg or look out or have a mantra, that's one thing. But when I enter the Zendo, I'm making a commitment to a group practice.
Yeah.
And I shouldn't be doing something that's going to disturb the others.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I've given the thing about the form and the chanting. So I think that's the big difference is you can have your own practice, but as soon as you join a group, there's a group practice.
Yeah.
That follows the form.
Yeah, it's a group practice, but you said we don't want to disturb the other. So if it's something that's making sound, like chanting a mantra out loud, that'd be pretty obvious. But I guess it's still a question: is does someone lying on the floor disturb the group practice if they're doing it quietly? Some might say, yeah, it does. The atmosphere is different. And some might say, no, it really doesn't. We're facing a wall. We don't even know they're there. So I think there's the disturbance issue, and then there's also the issue that maybe even if it doesn't disturb others, there's something beautiful in the agreement of, like you say, forms and like chanting, for example. It's kind of like of hearing a chorus, and one person's like, I'm just gonna like sing on a different note just for fun. I say, well, no, but we're trying to create something beautiful together. And that's why we have this form that we've, and there are other groups maybe of like chaos or improv chorus. You can just do whatever you want. Like I told this person, there are other dharma groups too where they don't emphasize the posture so much. I think it is somewhat unique in the Zen tradition that we emphasize this posture. So I think there are groups where there's other people lying down or standing on their head or whatever. But then I wonder, is that partly what makes our Zen tradition maybe not as popular as these kind of whatever goes groups? Is it a little too narrow? I think it probably is for some people. Or like Tenzin Roshi says, when conformity is held up as the main point, something has been denied in the psyche of the people. And that generates a projection of an other. And I think Zen, all spiritual traditions can have this, like, well, there's people that can just like take any posture they want. They don't get the true way of upright Shikan Taza. Yes.
I did a retreat with Joko Beck in the 90s, and somehow it came up about the same issue about, you know, what goes and what's... Mm. And she says what she always does, and I do it sometimes when I remember, when I think I've got a real strong point and I really believe it, the question is, how do I do this to be so? You ask yourself, and that helps me when I remember it. Give me some perspective.
Yeah.
Maybe there's certain, okay, and then I can say for this reason, for this reason, for this reason.
Mm-hmm.
If it's enough, then okay, we'll let it stand for now, but that condition may change.
Mm-hmm.
But just asking that question has been helpful to me.
Yeah, about a belief in particular. Yeah. Yeah, a belief. How do I know it is so? And that's why listening is good too, because you can say, I know it's so because of these three points. And then, if we're really listening, we say, well, you have the opposite view, and you probably think it's so too. What are your points? And then they maybe list another three that, all right, but I didn't think of those.
Yes.
So then we're like, well, there's, yeah, it enlarges the picture. Yeah. Yeah. And still, I don't discount my three, but now my picture's bigger. It includes those three, which maybe just means my view of, like, there's nothing possible that could be virtuous about that view. It's just total delusion. And I say, no, actually, they do have some points there. I don't even necessarily agree with them, but I see it where they're coming from.
Right. And there's a larger perspective.
Yeah, yeah. That's nice. Good question. How do I know it is so?
A bigger container.
Yeah, yeah. And how do I know it is so? We can ask again. There's like, I might say, there's infinite depth, deepening of this question. How do I know it is so? We can take that to like, you know, I'm sitting in a zendo right now. I'm talking with you all. How do I know it is so? You know, these really basic. That's like a belief, right? That's a belief that we almost think is not a belief. We take it for granted. And again, someone might say, no, there is an end to the deepening of this questioning. How do I know it is so?
Your depth to yourself, the depth to the other person, and acknowledgement, and being able to communicate and accept what you can accept and then not accept, but then at least you're communicating openly with that person and accepting them for who they are and how they are.
Yeah. Yeah.
And hopefully they're doing the same for you.
Yeah. Acceptance also, I think another nice point when we talk about acceptance is it doesn't mean agreeing with.
Yeah.
When we accept someone, it doesn't mean we have to agree with them. We just accept that they are one of the 7 billion people on the planet who has views and beliefs like I do, and due to all the conditions of their whole life that led up to this view, and the conditions are different, we could even say we don't even choose our beliefs and views. I think this is another layer of subtlety here. Is they're given to us by all the conditions of our life, and we might even say previous lives. Just the culmination of all of these conditions creates who we are, which includes our views. And then the funny thing is, instead of just saying, well, I couldn't have any other view according to the conditions that have created me, we think that we created it. We think, I produced this belief, this view, and therefore I hold it really strongly. It's like, well, we didn't even come up with it. It was given to us.
Unconscious conditioning.
Yeah, unconscious conditioning. We can make it more and more conscious. Yes, Arne?
To me, I feel like one of the biggest paradoxes of Zen is like the sensation of loss of agency sometimes, like in Sashin, it's it's complete loss of agency in a way. And yet...
You mean you're giving up your will to the form?
Yeah. And then on the other hand, I can recognize from my experience that it does actually seem to lead to some type of whatever freedom in some bigger sense.
Yeah.
It's but it's so vexing too, also this idea of our practice being for all, to liberate all beings and to help all beings, when I think so much of what we do is deeply inaccessible to so many too. And that's so paradoxical too. And
the Zen practices.
Yeah.
Mm.
And or our practice isn't accessible to ourselves in so many contexts. It's so hard for me to maybe go to Zazen in a noisy place.
Mm-hmm.
Can't accomplish any kind of stillness, and so it's also these things we say are so important, and it becomes kind of absurd in some contexts.
Yeah, those are great paradoxes that you bring up. And the first one of this we give up all our, we put ourselves in this straitjacket or bamboo tube, right, to give up our agency in order to leap off the top of the pole, go beyond ourselves. So once we understand that, then we can understand how, not just Zen, but many spiritual traditions have these very kind of strict containers. And, this idealized vision that I spoke of, that I've had in the past, comes from my own experience of wow, when you put yourself in a tighter and tighter bamboo tube, something amazing comes out of that. If you give a little wiggle room, it's a little less amazing in certain ways, in my own experience. So that the power of going beyond what we even think is possible, we break free of our limitations of who we think we are. And it's beautiful. And it's dangerous, because we can forget that that's the purpose of it, and just be tighter tube, screw down those clamps. And so, yeah, that's a great paradox to keep in mind. And then the other one of, it seems like it's so difficult for all beings. It's a kind of a narrow path. I think in a certain sense that's true, and the more we say, there's a certain form, the traditional Zen form of sitting in a certain posture, maybe we don't fully embrace choosing however you want just out of personal preference in every situation, and therefore some people will just, it doesn't sound fun. and so they won't come to it. And yet, the other half of the paradox is, it's so open. It's like, you know, since the, as Tenshin Roshi says, the ultimate truth is like, no one can grasp that, actually. It's not limited to a particular Zen form whatsoever. It's just like, this is the particular, maybe like, training, expression of opening to the ungraspable. But the opening to the ungraspable can happen in infinite forms. So you could say that, that's the good news, that that's open to everybody, and people do discover it in so many ways other than Zen practice. And then it brings up the questions, well, if that's possible, then what about skillful means? Should we open our Zen practice to include other skillful means that open people to the ungraspable? And we say, no, because then it's not Zen practice anymore. Well, but isn't it really just about opening to the ungraspable? And I think if we really said that's what it is, then maybe we would break down all the forms. But I think I would understand that we say it is ultimately about opening to the ungraspable and the complete freedom and joy in that opening. But it's also about maintaining a certain style, the family wind, you know, we say, of how to do that, which is, you could say, and that's not the ultimate truth, but it's kind of beautiful too. Just like you could say, well, isn't Beethoven and the Rolling Stones equally beautiful? Yes, but let's not kind of like mix them together. That's, you know, at this concert we'll listen to Beethoven and this one we'll listen to the Rolling Stones and appreciate them both on their own grounds. Yes?
As far as following the forms or yielding to the forms, I find that, for one thing, that allows me to let go of my way. And which is always going to be a good thing, to drop my way and accept the form.
Yeah.
The other thing is, there's a phrase that keeps going through my head. And no doubt, the universe is unfolding as it should. Mm.
Yes.
And what the key word there is unfolding. So that what I can accept is, this is the way it is now. You know, who am I to say how we get from there to here? Or, you know, we're certainly not, it's not going to stay the same.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But a lot of times it will go through my head lately. No doubt the universe is unfolding as it should.
Yeah. In other words, like...
Maybe, you know, there's a sign in that acceptance. You heard that.
Yeah. But it's not under our control.
That's somehow where the forms support me, because I come here and I follow the forms every Wednesday and we do this. It doesn't matter what's going on in the rest of the world.
Yeah, that's something beautiful about the form.
Can carry us through anything.
Yeah. Yeah. They create a stable kind of container in which to open to boundless, ungraspable change.
And I've made my vow that this is my way, even if I don't understand what it means to save all beings. It didn't say that I had to understand that.
Yeah, and this is my way. We have, you know, that's a paradox too, because how narrowly do we define? Is it like it has to be always, you know, it's my interpretation of Zen practice always, right? So, and I just, you know, my own experience, I know my interpretation of Zen practice has greatly evolved, luckily, over the years. If it stayed static, that would be scary. And so I keep opening to it, but then at some point maybe it goes beyond and it's no longer even Zen practice.
My interpretation is just words. It's an idea. It's a story that I make up.
Yeah.
It's what I do.
Yeah.
Sitting.
Mm-hmm.
And that's not a story. It may be a story I make up about it, but it's the act, I think, of following that form.
Yeah, it's a story when we think about it or tell other people about what it is. Then it's our story of sitting, but the actual sitting is free of our stories. Yes, last question, and it's time.
It's time. The phrase that runs through my head with all these threads is, they say there are as many minds as there are people, still they all negotiate the way through Zazen. In that case, what Zazen?
There's nothing that's not it in that case. If we really say all people, all beings in the world negotiate the way solely through Zazen, that's a kind of a nice line of Dogen to interpret after he's just said. Well, we actually studied this Fukan Zazengi that Rachel's quoting this last December Sesshin, and there's some great turns in there. Like Dogen says, the Zazen I speak of is not a matter of sitting or lying down. And then right after that he says, at the sight of your sitting, put a cushion down and cross your legs like this. So it goes back and forth between, it doesn't depend on any posture, and here's the posture. And all beings negotiate the way solely in Zazen. But what is this Zazen? It includes everything, and yet it's manifests in the family style of this particular form that we keep alive. Even within Zen, there's these issues of these different lineages of Zen that there seems to be in ancient times this strong devotion to keeping these lineages like a pure stream of family style that's different from the other Zen lineage. Like one of our ancestors is like, the Soto Zen lineage was about to die out, and that teacher could not find a successor, so he had this Rinzai Zen teacher kind of hold the lineage until he could find a Soto successor, which is really emphasizing that there's two different family styles, and it's beautiful to keep them alive and not mix them. And yet, someone from the other lineage can hold that lineage and pass it on too. This is like art. Can we wait till after?
Yeah. Just one quick
Okay.
Saying that having Simone Satchinanda, who's founder of my yoga lineage, says the paths are many, but the truth is one.
Nice. Mm-hmm. The paths are many, but the truth is one. Yes. And that leads right into this final poem I'll leave you with from Zen Master Rumi, our Sufi poet saint, about this very point. This one's called, "This We Have Now." This we have now is not imagination. This is not grief or joy, not a judging state or an elation or sadness. Those come and go. This is the presence that doesn't. It's dawn, Husam, here in the splendor of coral, inside the friend, the simple truth of what Halaj said. What else could human beings want? When grapes turn to wine, they're wanting this. When the night sky pours by, it's really a crowd of beggars, and they all want some of this. This that we are now created the body, cell by cell, like bees building a honeycomb. The human body and the universe grew from this, not this from the universe and the human body. And this is our last Dharma talk for the year. We'll close next week, and if you can come to New Year's Eve, that's a beautiful way to celebrate the turning of the calendar year. And then we'll start again, fresh. May our intention equally extend to every being and place with the true merit of Buddha's way. Beings are numberless. I vow to save them. Delusions are inexhaustible. I vow to end them. Dharma gates are boundless. I vow to enter them. Buddha's ways unsurpassable. I vow to be coming.